I love her. I love her very much. I've never had a feeling like
shut
this.
Up.
And speaking of love, weren't you and I going to talk about that today?
Yes, we were.
But, well, couldn't you manage to arrange your time so you could have a little fun, too?
Everyone, welcome to VomCom, the podcast about the romantic comedies you love to hate
and hate to love. We'd like to acknowledge that the recording of this podcast takes place both in the region of Peel, which is part of the treaty lands and territory of the Mississaugas of the Credit,
and Ottawa, which was built on unceded Anishinaabe Algonquin Nation territory. I have been very excited for this episode.
Me too. I just want to talk about like every single part.
I know. Me too. This movie that we're covering this week is one of my comfort movies.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it really is, I get like very influenced by the aesthetic of a movie and mm-hmm. the like context and setting. And like a lot of the time, I'm like, oh, I just want to live in that movie for a little while. Like I kind of get carried away. One of my favorite, I don't know if you say time period or like, it's a fictional time period, like my idealized version of it is like mm-hmm. Regency England. So, you know, I love to watch this movie, which is Austenland, because I don't think we mentioned it yet.
No, not yet.
I love watching this movie as like a comfort movie.
Yeah. Me too. I can't remember what I watched or what I did first, because there is Austenland, which came out in 2013, is based off of a novel, which came out in 2007, which is written by Shannon Hale. And Shannon Hale also wrote, co-wrote the script for Austenland, and along with the director of Austenland, Jerusha Hess. So I can't remember what I did first.
Who is also the director of Napoleon Dynamite.
Yes, I found that out today.
Which kind of makes sense.
I never knew that. Her and her husband, Jared Hess, because I clicked on Jerusha Hess's Wikipedia, and it took me to Jared. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is the wrong page. And when I clicked it again, it took me again to that page. And I was like, is Jerusha Hess now a trans man?
Oh.
And then
that
I was like,
thought, yeah.
That was my thought. I was like, oh, okay. So I should make sure to say that. And then it was like Jared and Jerusha. And I'm like, Jerusha can't even get her own Wikipedia page. And like, there's
wait,
not
seriously?
Even a photo. Yeah. There's not even a photo of her. It's literally of Jared, which is why I kept clicking away. But yeah, Napoleon Dynamite, Nacho Libre. No, I was like, ew, a man? Gross.
In this economy? Ugh.
Ugh. So yeah, Napoleon Dynamite, Nacho Libre, and then Gentleman Broncos.
Yeah, I never
saw
that
very
one, the last one.
No, neither have I. But very specific kind of movie. Which, having now seen Austenland and like those first two movies mentioned, I can kind of see it now.
There's a very similar visual lexicon between all of the movies. It's stylized kind of twee aesthetic, I would say. A bit quirky, indie twee type
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very. And then also seeing a photo of her, I was like, yes, that is the kind of person
mm-hmm.
who would, who would direct this movie. So, I can't remember what I did first. I tried to finish I picked up the book again recently
mm-hmm.
to try to read it before this recording, and then I just didn't end up finishing it. But I realized that I like the book a lot more than I think I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
Almost want to say that I like it a little bit more than the movie, but there are good and bad things about it, I think. But if anyone just wants like a really nice, entertaining, easy read, definitely pick up Austenland, especially if you like all of the things that we just mentioned. Regency England,
check.
If you're a slut for Mr. Darcy,
check.
If you like, what else do you like? Pretend.
Check.
Fake relationships.
Check.
If you like...
horseback riding in the rain. Check.
There you go. That's all you need.
What else do
then
you
pick
need?
Up this book. Yeah. I'm definitely going to keep reading it
mm-hmm.
after we record this episode because it is actually kind of entertaining.
It kind of makes sense to me that this was based on a book. You ever watch a movie and you go, feel like I'm missing something. It makes sense, Austin. Like, it makes sense in its entirety, but you feel like that there's some subtext or extraneous text that you didn't get. That's what I see sometimes when there's film adaptations of books. And I think it's because the people who are making the film are reading the book so closely and trying to squirrel out all of the best, most important parts, because you need to really, like, what's that word when you, like, do something to a metal where you make it really hard and in its purest form?
That's not something I know. Alchemy? I don't know what that, but while you're looking it up, I was going to say this exact same thing, because reading the book, I was like, whoa, there's a lot of context that you kind of assume in the book, in the movie, but it's not like shown to you as much as it is in the book, which is understandable, but I kind of like that we were given a lot more like subtext in the book about Jane and her relationships and her mishaps with love, because then I think it builds her character a bit more.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there's things that were not said that you were supposed to know. That would have been in the book. That's the kind of thing you would have heard from an internal monologue or whatever in a book that you just don't see in the movie.
Exactly.
Kat, did you find a good synopsis?
So the one that IMDb provides is really, frankly, quite rude.
Oh no. Are they making fun of nerd girls?
No. This is all it says. Obsessed with Pride and Prejudice 1995, a woman travels to a Jane Austen theme park in search for her perfect gentleman. That's all it says. Which is obviously not wrong, but they don't even say Jane? And it's also not a theme park.
Well, they really gave the log line and that's it.
Yeah. That's it.
Bit dry.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, that's why you guys are here, because you want to get the color commentary on this movie. So if you thought that logline was a bit dry, we've got great news for you, because there's so much more information coming soon. I did a little bit of contextual research for this movie, which, as you said, came out in 2013. You mentioned who it was directed by, the Hesses, plural.
The Hesses. The director's
Hess, if you will. And then the music was actually composed by this guy called Ilan Eshkeri, who I saw his name pop up on the IMDb and I was like, why do I know that name? It's because he also did the soundtrack for Stardust, which came out in 2007. One of my favorite soundtracks of all time. So that was the one with Claire Danes, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Tristan Thorne, and I think Robert De Niro was in that, actually. So that was a great
movie. Yeah, a lot of big names in that movie.
I felt like that one really flew. I mean, let's not get into commentary on that movie. That's not what this particular podcast is about. But yeah, there's some interesting stuff about this movie. It was not commercially successful. It cost about, where was it? It said how much it cost. So the budget for this movie was about £5 million.
Okay.
Pounds. Okay.
So yeah.
UK currency. The gross worldwide.
Yeah.
Like sales. Were $2 million.
Oh, dollars.
So, yeah, $2 million. So that is not great. And it also, you know, I think everyone knew what this movie was when it came out. Everyone looked at it and they were like, this is a nice fluffy romance with the additional benefit of having period dress. So that's what the attraction is. And everyone who went to see it, they knew what they liked. And that's, I gotta say, good for you guys.
Yeah.
It doesn't have like horrendous ratings. Like on IMDb, it's got a 6.3 out of 10 based on 20,000 reviews. Okay.
Which is surprising to me.
Yeah, I honestly thought people would really trash this. It got a 42% on Metacritic.
Wow.
Not the best, but I honestly thought it was gonna be like really low, because it has all the markers of a movie that movie critics wouldn't like. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which is our specialty here.
Yep.
The lead in this movie is Carrie Russell, and her ally or friend in the movie is played by Jennifer Coolidge. And I made a joke to Amy that, oh man, I'm 100% sure Jennifer Coolidge just improv'd all of her lines, like, as a joke. And then the first trivia fact that comes up when you go to the IMDb page for Austin Land is that most of Jennifer Coolidge's lines were made up on the spot. According to the producers, it was almost impossible to get her to memorize the script. Which I love so much. She brings so much joy to this movie.
She really does. And that makes a lot of sense considering... Mm-hmm. Some of the shit she says, like, it is funny, and, okay, I'm not here to bash Jennifer Coolidge at all. Mm-hmm. I am not here to do that, because I love her, okay? I will say, however funny her improvisations were, they were not always the best choices, because there are a lot of things that are kind of, like, left open-ended, or they didn't have the equivalent kind of reaction to it. And it's just kind of like, sometimes it's just like an off screen kind of joke that she says that is kind of funny only because it's bizarre, not because it's like genuinely funny and good for the moment, you know?
There's literally one scene where they're playing cards or something, and one lady is like, oh my god, your skin is so nice, and she's like, thank you, when I'm alone at night, I put my face in the fire. And I was just like, what? Why did you put that in the movie?
Yeah, exactly. That was also one of the, that's one of the ones where she's like, I leave my face in the fire, and then it kind of, it goes to everyone else to kind of react to it, and everyone's reactions usually are like, oh, okay. And they just kind of move on.
Yeah, and then, like, you just... Yeah, and sometimes I think that they, subbed in a little bit of voiceover for an off-screen character to try and make it make sense a bit more. Because then, in the background, you hear, like, Amelia going, oh, your face is like porcelain. Your skin is like porcelain. That makes sense. You're in, and then someone goes, oh, because she's been putting it in the kiln or something like that. And I was like, okay, they made it work. I feel like they had a lot of fun making this movie, probably.
Yeah. Which is, like... what you expect of it when you're looking at it, and which is why, like, I really enjoy it, because it's just like a fun romp, and it's not more than it has to be, and that's how it's been presented to us, and I understand, I get that, I love it, but me and the way that I think and, like, read and just always wanting more from things, and, like, especially things that I really like, I'm always like, oh, you could just do this or take out this line and then do better here and then do it like this and this and this. So, like, it is, I love it the way that it is. Do I wish it was a little bit better so I could love it more? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1,000%. How
would,
yes.
If you had to give, like, a 2 or 3 sentence synopsis for this movie, what would you say? Because, like, I feel like if you guys, as usual, if our dear listeners at this point have not seen the movie, there will be spoilers ahead. So if you haven't seen Austin Land in brackets 2013, go watch it and then come back. But Kat, what would you say? What kind of synopsis would you say?
Okay. The phrase "down on her luck" is coming to me. Mm-hmm. Cause you need to say that, like, this woman is not lucky in love.
She is unlucky in love. That's for sure.
Unlucky in love, Jane, goes to... Oh my god, this is so hard for me. I know what I want to say, but putting them in sentences will take 7 hours.
Okay.
So something about unlucky in love, Jane, goes to Jane Austen Playhouse.
Yeah, that's it. I mean,
yeah,
it's like
goes
the
to
Jane
Austen,
Austen
Playhouse
experience. I would listen to that podcast.
Wow, I would too.
I would,
you know,
also.
There's like immersive Van Gogh. This is
yeah,
it.
Immersive Jane Austen.
Down on her. Wait, what did we say?
Unlucky
in
love,
Jane. Jane goes to an immersive Jane Austen experience for one last chance at love.
Yes. I mean, I always think to myself, was she going here because she thought she was going to find a romantic relationship here? Or did she just want to experience the fantasy?
Yeah. See, that's a thing that they don't really make clear in the movie. She's uh-huh. just kind of like, I've had it. Her final straw in the movie is that her, like, one of her ex-boyfriends hears that she has just been dumped by, like, her most recent boyfriend. And what's it called? And he's like, hey, baby, and, like, slaps her ass in her work cubicle.
Inappropriate. Oh my God, so whack. And he's like, yeah. I'm as good as it gets, Janie. Mid-30s. Yeah,
he's like, you're 30-something.
Ah, I'm out of here.
And she's like, this can't be it. I have to find something else. And then she goes and takes out her life savings
mm-hmm.
to then go on this trip. And she goes to a travel agent to book this trip with her best friend with her, who was like, you're going to take out your life savings for this? And she's like, I have to do something. So
which makes me wonder, how much was this? What were her theoretical life savings? How much would you pay for this experience? Say she stayed there a week. A week where you go to a place completely immersed in Jane Austen, hobbies, clothes, food, everything.
To me?
Yeah, whole week.
This sounds like to me a $20,000 thing.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Exactly to the cent. Exactly what wow. I was thinking.
Amazing. Wow. Because
we're so in tune.
We're having McDonald's, thinking the mm-hmm. same thoughts.
Yeah.
The reason why I thought
that. Tame our flyaways with high ponytail. Unsuccessfully. Unlucky in hair.
My God, the title of my memoir.
Mm. Anyways.
So, watching this movie recently, I was like, there are a lot of, like, background actors or, like, people who are working on this estate. Because,
mm-hmm.
one, it does take a lot of money to run an estate.
Yeah, also they general. Provided all the clothes once they got there, yeah. which means that
they provided were, like, all the clothes. All the tapered. Big yeah. Yes, exactly. And all the like big not banquets, but like big dinners and lunches mm-hmm. and stuff that they have and like all of the decorations and like each time they're doing a thing, it's decorated with like little tea cakes and all that stuff. So who's baking all that, huh? So hers, if she got the copper package, mm-hmm. at $20,000. Can you imagine what, like, Jennifer Coolidge / Miss Elizabeth Charming paid or Lady Amelia Hartwright paid? If they're, like, on the platinum whatever level and they got the fancier dresses yeah. and the fancier rooms. Probably, like, what, 50, 60,000?
I think, yeah. I think it the mind boggles because it's not just... I mean, you could easily pay... Like, I'm trying to think of what is, like, a random Fairmont, you could easily pay $1,000 a night.
Yeah.
Right? And that's just a room. So, mm-hmm. imagine, you know, a full inclusive, I don't know if the airfare is included, they really don't get into the nitty gritty, and I don't think mm-hmm. that would interest any of our listeners.
No.
But, like, if you think about it, it's, like, food, clothes, actors, maintain, like, and pay a little bit to, like, you know, maintain the place. Housekeeping, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Yeah, like kitchen staff, like all the staff. There's so many staff, and then
there's so
like,
many
all of the activities that they do. So they do a play at one point. They go fake duck hunting at one point. They go horseback riding. So that means they have to buy the like this place bought horses and maintains the horses in a whole stable. So this place is like full, like all the bells and whistles, right? I think that $20,000 is a conservative
yeah.
for what that would be. Now, to be fair, this was nearly 10 years ago, so our theoretical guess makes a bit more sense.
Oh, but my God.
I know.
Almost 10 years ago. That's crazy.
Yeah. Anyways, I'm thinking, you know, it's obviously a very expensive thing to do, mm-hmm. and that is something that absolutely you could charge through the nose for
yes.
people, and they would absolutely do that.
Exactly.
I would do that.
I was going to say, I would yeah. do this. I would love to do this. If I
oh, yeah.
became rich today, I would do this. There's nothing. You're telling me I'm going to go to a place where, yes, there are running toilets. Thank God.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to give me all the clothes. You're going to provide all the food. And then I just have to dress up and like talk to men and like banter and flirt.
And like maybe play the piano a little bit.
And maybe play the piano a little bit. I would play the beginning couple of notes of, what's the one that's like,
Furley's. Bro, the way that was the exact one that came into my mind too. Like, we are the same person. Why do we even talk? Like, we can just, like, look in each other's eyes and, like, telecommunicate. Telecommunicate? What?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I questioned myself as soon as the word came out. But Amy and I looked it up, and there actually are a couple places in the world that do something like this. There's this one in Vermont, actually, of all places. So it's not in England, but it's this, like, lady who runs an estate, and she does, like, weekends. And then there's a place in England where you can go and they have like a one day every few months or something. There's this lady in England who does a similar thing, but it's just like one day or 2 days and you learn like etiquette and like how to eat at a table and how to dance and a few things like that. But people come all dressed up. I would love to do that. Love.
Oh, I'm surprised. I thought you wouldn't want to do like the acting thing, like the pretending to be like an actual character.
I think it would be a little bit stressful at first because I'd be worried about my like language. I wouldn't want to try too hard or say something that's like completely off script. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it would be a little stressful, but I think in the overall it would be like super fun.
Especially
getting to dress up and like walk around like a country estate, like hello.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Yeah, that's what I want to be doing now. Okay, so good. So we're on the same page, so we'll go. Yeah. We'll book it. Okay.
Okay, so we'll go. Okay. So we're going to Austin. Great.
So in the book, actually, and I forgot this, but this is the part that I'm at now. Her, Jane kind of has a conversation with, like, her grandmother, her great aunt or something. Mm-hmm. And she mentions to her that she's, like, not lucky in love and all men are shit and the only good men are fictional. Mm-hmm. And her great aunt's like, interesting, okay. And you love this Jane Austen person? And Jane's like, yes, I do. And then, like, a week later or something, the great aunt dies. And I think she has a lot of money, and then she's left everybody something. And then for Jane, she leaves her this trip. She buys her the ticket for this trip. So that's how Jane affords this.
Honestly, I would have preferred if that was how they did it in the movie, because it would have made a lot more sense. And it also would have replaced that really clumsy intro montage that they did, where they half-assedly showed like maybe two or three scenes of Jane's earlier life, where she just, it's very clear that she's obsessed with Pride and Prejudice, but like it was really unnecessary. Like you could have done one scene where she interacted with someone and shown all of that in a more eloquent way, but I feel like it was just... Yeah, it was a bit, I don't know. I don't even know. It just felt kind of like daytime TV-ish, the way that they montaged it together. It was a bit like a sitcom montage.
I
thought that was a bit weird.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I like that situation you just described, because that could have been one scene where it opens on her having the conversation with her great aunt or her grandma or whatever, and then the next one we find out that she passed away and left her this experience, and it would have taken the exact same amount of screen time. But it would have been a bit more elegant, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also, I don't think that this montage, like, did Jane any service, because they're showing how, like, no one understands her love, her Pride and Prejudice, or Jane Austen, or Mr. Darcy, or whatever. And, like, one of the scenes with her ex-boyfriend is that they're in her apartment, they have Pride and Prejudice on, and it's, like, something that she's seen 1,000 times, and this man is literally kissing on her neck, and she's like, stop, stop. But this is my like favorite part, and then he gets frustrated, and like her apartment is covered with like Jane Austen things, Mr. Darcy things, especially I think the most atrocious thing is the lettering that she in her bedroom, in her adult mid 30-year-old bedroom, she has the letters in like felt or something, Mr. Darcy was here, above her bed.
Really horrific stuff.
Horrific stuff. And then so like her boyfriend
Chris
gets Hansen's
about to walk in and tell her to stop being such a fucking creep.
So like this man gets frustrated and leaves her, punches her Mr. Darcy Colin Firth cutout, and it's like,
rip.
Jane, who can blame him? Look at your life, look at your decisions.
You're a grown-ass woman, and you've got
you're a grown-ass woman lady
dolls multiple dolls
Yeah.
I reiterate.
What are the dolls? I was like, what do the dolls have to do with
I don't Jane maybe Austen? It was supposed to, the whole thing was just, oh man, I really hated her apartment so much.
Me too.
And then she took away, so her friend goes, you know what, Jane, go, if you're going to spend all your money on this, go do the experience, enjoy it. But if you get your bubble burst that this fantasy that you really, really want to experience is actually not worth the hype, you have to de-Darcy-fy or whatever your apartment. And I was like sitting here being like, this is a good friend. She's seen that her friend is, this is an intervention. She's like, you are obsessed. It's unhealthy. Okay. And it, you know, when you go do your thing, like go to England, go do the thing. That's fine. But like, this is going to be a learning experience for you, essentially is what she knew. And then at one point Jane goes, like she her friend looks around the room and she goes, this is out of control. And Jane just whispers under her breath. She's like, it's a hobby. And she just like, she's just so, I have a theory that Jane is like autism coded or neurodivergent coded, because she has her hyperfixation, which is Pride and Prejudice and Mr. Darcy specifically. She's got her entire house completely dedicated to it. She only ever wants to talk about that thing. Like, that's her main interest. She knows, she's memorized like the passages from the books and stuff. I'm like, oh my God, she's a neurodivergent. That's my theory.
Whoa.
Yeah.
See, why can't they just include these things? You know why they can't? Because then they make it all about that thing. And instead of like, instead of her just being like a person also wanting to find love, they're like, this autistic 30-year-old woman. Like, no, just chill out.
Yeah, calm down, Sia.
Yeah. So despite like the montage not doing her any favors, Jane herself is still kind of like our cute little heroine who is trying really hard to get this right, because a lot is riding on this. Like, literally her whole life savings is riding on this experience. So her friend Molly her friend Molly, before Jane leaves, gives her a dress that she made for her to wear to the airport or whatever. And Jane shows up in England already wearing the costume. Dedication right off the bat. We love it. And her Mr. Darcy tote bag, which I will look for.
Yep.
Because you know why? Also, they make that tote bag, like, hers has big old straps.
Oh, yeah. And if it's one thing about you, it's not snug on
her armpit.
It's that you love a tote bag.
Yeah.
You're a real slut for a tote bag.
Shout out to our mutual friend Emma, who bought me a tote bag yesterday. Thank you.
Was it like, was there something cute on it?
It was from Fika Cafe.
Oh, danke.
Yeah, it was a donkey.
Shout out to Emma. One thing that I noted was that when Jane starts her journey, she gets on the plane and she lands in England, and you see like the different scenes of England. They're playing the song, Heaven is a Place on Earth. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And then I just started laughing.
Baby. That one?
Yeah. Do you know what that's worth? That one.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking to myself, like, heaven on earth is Austin Land with Jennifer Coolidge. Oh, yeah, baby. That was so funny to me. I was like, oh, my God. The music choices throughout were a bit dodgy. But it was, they were played for laughs. It was all good.
Yeah. Yeah. I, like, love and hate the music choices in this movie.
Yeah, same. There's a lot of things that I love and hate about this movie. There's one scene where once she arrives, in case you guys are not familiar with the plot of Pride and Prejudice, it's kind of a enemies to lovers trope where Mr. Darcy and Lizzie Bennet, they at first do not like each other, and then by the end of the book, they come to love each other. This movie follows the same rough storyline, and except Lizzie is Jane, and our Darcy is Mr. Nobly. Which is such a funny name, because they're like, oh, we have this actor who's playing a noble character. What do we call him? Mr. Noble? One more degree of separation is needed here. We'll call him Mr. Nobly, and then no one will notice. But yeah, so there's one scene where they're they're out doing that fake duck hunting, and then on their way back, Jane's horse stops glitches. And so, like, Brett from Flight of the Conchords is in this movie, and he takes her horse away and just doesn't come back with a horse. She has to end up walking all the way back to the main house where they are all staying. During the course of her walk, it starts raining. Heavy, heavy downpour. And Mr. Nobly comes out of nowhere on a horse and then just hops off and is like, get up on the horse. She's like, what the heck? He's like, come on, let's go. If we want to outrun the rain, which, by the way, it's currently raining all over them. They're not going to outrun it. They're in it. You're in the eye of the storm, guys. And then he's like, come on, you got to hop up on the horse. In order for us to outrun the rain, we have to both be on the horse together. You got to ride, you know. She hops up. She's side saddle. He's like, no, no, no. You got to, like, straddle the horse. She's like, I can't. My dress is my skirts. He rips her skirt from hem to waist fully. And I was just like, a little tiny scream escaped me because I was like, the costume designer must cry themselves to sleep. Must have cried themselves to sleep that day. But anyways, so, you know, it's this whole like, oh, there's only one horse, we have to ride together. Oh no, what do we do? And then so he hops up behind her and then they ride back to the main house. And I feel like the potential for that setup was amazing, but it didn't play out very well because it was rushed. It was weirdly rushed. And it didn't quite make sense the way it was edited together. You just see her in the field standing there, then all of a sudden she's walking, and you can tell that they've color corrected it to make it look like it's stormy in the background. and then cut to her soaking wet, her hair's all fucked up, her hat's gone. Like, she's in the woods now. What? Give us 2 seconds of her, like, walking through the brambles and, like, getting her hair messed up or something to just bridge those two things together, you know?
Yeah.
There's just no... It did not flow. And that really bugged me because that's like... Oh, man. Horseback riding in the rain? You know? Like, the potential is through the roof on that. I would love to direct that scene.
Everything about that scene, there was so much, it was like just so close, but just adjacent to what we wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And like, even to get to that scene, the leading up to it. So like you said, the reason why she ended up walking was because her horse just stopped walking. They were riding back. Brett is riding his horse beside her. And then she goes, excuse me, this horse is broken, because the horse is just standing there.
Just standing
and
there.
And then she gets off, and he's like, oh, I'm so sorry about that, missus. Miss, I'll get you a new horse. So he's like, I'll be back with a new horse. Starts pulling the horse away. The horse is walking.
Right? Also, could she have not just walked with him?
Right, because he's walking two horses.
Yeah, and at this point, they have a budding romance, so that would have been a great opportunity for them to... I mean, at that point, they could have just been on the horses and been riding together and talking. You know what I mean? It just didn't make sense.
Exactly.
Make it make sense. Ugh. You know what I'm saying?
Make it make sense. And then...
When he walked away with the horse, I was like, maybe we don't know something about horses. Maybe there's something that we just don't know.
I know. I was like, what? Did I miss? Did they say... a new like an actual reason, because she just goes, this horse is broken, and he's like, oh, sorry about that, because she made a joke about it being like a copper package horse.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's pretty much it. And then she gets off the horse, he's like, I'll be back with a new one, starts walking away with the horse, and then she just stands there waiting, when I would have been like, why can't I just come with you? You're clearly
I'll just come too.
So no, like, so many of the things in this movie is just, like, clumsily kind of, like, thrown together to then give opportunities for her and the love interest to, like, have moments. And those are one of the things that, like, really does not sit right with me, because it's, like, you have good actors. You have Carrie Russell and J.J. Field, who we haven't mentioned by name, who, I will stand by this, is half Lee Pace and half Tom Hiddleston.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1,000%. What J.J. Field is to me.
Yeah. And if you close your eyes and just listen to his voice, he sounds like Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
And did you notice that?
No. But, like, I understand what you're saying, because it's, like, a deep,
it literally sounds soothing. It sounds exactly. Yeah. At one point, I looked away from the screen, and I was like, who does that sound like? Snape.
Snape.
Snape in a little waistcoat.
So much potential, because when in the later half of the movie, when they do have interesting scenes together, it's mm-hmm. good. They're good together. Everything else around it, how they get there is very clumsy, like crawling through mud to get yeah. to the romance.
And there's, I feel and... like there was just a lot of, there was a lot of dead air time that could have mm-hmm. been used to make it make sense.
Yes. What other things do you have in your notes?
I wanted to talk about the stable boy fantasy.
Yes.
So Jane has gone to a place where all the visitors are promised. It's a bunch of visitors, patrons of Austin Land, interacting with actors from Austin Land. And as a patron, you are guaranteed a romantic plot of your own while you're there. So Jane shows up and she thinks, okay, I've got the copper package. Things seem to be, like, there are some exclusions, all right? So I guess I'm not getting the romance. And then she starts falling for one of the staff who is ostensibly not an actor, played by Brett from Flight of the Conchords. Brett. Mm-hmm. I don't actually know what his last name is. Do you know what his last
McKenzie.
Name is? McKenzie. Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords. And...
Britt.
Britt. Britt McKenzie. Britt. He plays the guy who, like, runs the stable. I guess he's the stable
yeah.
boy, stable man. And dreamy, right? A stable man? We're going to get one of those. Sorry. but like, the whole time she's falling for him, you're like, oh, he just works there. He's not one of the actors.
Yeah, because he's and presenting then, himself like that. He's fully like, because, I'm not one of those clowns. Yeah,
because he's straight up lying and saying that he's not an actor, which is mm-hmm. just one of the many ethical conundrums with Austin Land, which is my next point, so I won't get into that yet. But anyways... He is her love interest. Everyone else's love interest is a nobleman. Mm-hmm. And then hers is a stable boy. And then I started thinking about it and I was like, wait a second, that is like a definite fantasy in like that style of book though, of like, you know, Lady Chatterley's Lover, like the more like contemporary stuff like that. It's like, oh, the help. They're mm-hmm. so burly. They have calluses on their hands, you know, etc. They're giving birth to horses. In the stable, which happens in this movie. And I just thought it was so funny that was part of the fantasy that they sold to her, was that mm-hmm. he gave birth to a horse and he shovels kelp off of the sluice, like, thing that leads into the water. Like, every time she interacts with him, he's doing some kind of chore. And I'm like, and I thought that was interesting that they worked that fantasy into it, because it's like, that is how they sold to her that he was not an actor, although he was. Yeah. The way that the people who run Austin Land frame it, they make it, they're mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, we're scripting your love interest for you. There's just like 8 levels of deception before you can get to it. So don't worry about it. Like, mm-hmm. that was crazy to me, because now I would love to talk about the ethical breaches of Austin Land.
Let's do it.
First and foremost being the fact that they sold her the idea that she was going to come and she was going to have her romance. But then the person who they had slated as her romantic interest presented himself as not being an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it's like that in the book, because that is just, like, that is really a mind fuck. If you go somewhere and you think that you're going to have a fake romance with an actor, but then someone comes along and goes, oh, can you get a load of these guys? I'm so glad I'm not an actor like them. I'm a real guy who you can have real conversations with and have, like, maybe a life after this. Like, he was mm-hmm. selling her that he was interested in her. And they were, like, making out and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, all this stuff. I was just like, he's going way too far, because he's an actor the whole time and actively telling her that he's not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck?
I can't remember. I think it's the same thing in the book, but I can't remember. I didn't get that far on the reread.
Mm.
Wee-weed.
Wee-wee? Best line in the whole movie.
Best line of, like, any movie. I think any movie should go into... the Library of Congress video archive or whatever.
Yeah.
Longest Trek. But yeah, that's what makes this whole thing so... Like, they literally... Mrs. Wattlesbrook.
Yeah.
And Brett, whose character name I can't... I don't even know. Like, it's here on IMDb. Oh, Martin.
Martin.
But, like, they really just fully manipulated her. Because at the end, Mrs. Wattlesbrook, like, they're doing her exit interview. And Jane says something, because Jane still doesn't know that Martin's an actor. And Jane goes, yeah, there was a romance, but it wasn't with who you originally scripted for me, which she thought, I think, was Mr. Nobly.
I thought she thought it was East. Captain East from the West. Didn't she think it was going to be East? It seemed like East was set up for her.
I think they brought in East to be set up with her. But I think she's referring to Nobly because it seemed like Nobly was going to propose to her at the ball. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what she thought. Because anything that he was saying, she was like, oh, these are the perfect lines for a character like you. And just kept complimenting him on his acting and his character work. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't believing Mr. Nobly, but was believing everything that the actual actor, Martin was saying. And I think Mr. East came in to distract her from Martin, because I think that's what Mrs. Wattlesbrook said, is that things got too steamy, so we had to take Martin out, and so he, like, fake broke up with her. But, like, they literally just did it so that she is blindsided by the fact that Mr. Nobly is not an actor, but he's a history professor who really likes history and just wanted to have the Jane Austen immersive experience and take some time off from his professoring duties.
And took the role as a favor to his aunt, who runs the place, by the way. So yes, he was the only actor, quote unquote, who was not actually an actor. He had no experience. And all his performance was him just doing his best and then actually falling in love with Jane.
Yes, exactly. So literally all of this ethical manipulation and stuff is just to blindside her to the fact that Mr. Henry Nobly is going to declare his actual feelings for her at the end of the movie. And she's like, what? It's obviously icky to watch. Because after you realize he was lying to her and he doesn't even, like, Martin was lying to her and he doesn't even care about her feelings or whatever, as is shown at the airport scene, you feel really bad for her. And, like, she thinks that she, like, this whole, everything that she's ever thought it has been true is a lie. Because, like, romance is dead. All the true gentlemen and real men worth knowing are only fictional. And she goes home and she cleans her apartment of all the Jane Austen-y things. And it's sad. Crying.
I thought you were, like, fake crying in your sleeve.
No, I had to, like, snort.
Cute.
Not snort.
I love that for you.
Inhale? Thank you.
Sneef? Okay, do you want to know my other ethical breaches that I listed? Okay. The owner's husband is a sexual deviant and maybe a molester. No one told her she got the cheap package before she got there.
Yep.
No one told her there were different tiers, gold, silver, etc., copper, hers, which was the least expensive. Also, they were snooping in her room looking through her stuff. They were going through her luggage when they found her cell phone. That's weird. Participants are barred from having technology, except it's a double standard because all the rich people who are there are allowed to have TVs in their room, etc., etc. But when Mrs. Wattlesbrook snoops through Jane's stuff, which is weird to begin with, and finds a cell phone that Jane brought with her but has used one time, she tries to make her leave, even though she's paid for the full experience and etc. It's like, that is highly whack. And also, if you have a cell phone and you're traveling abroad, you're obviously going to bring it with you and probably just leave it in your suitcase and not use it. So why is having a cell phone grounds to get kicked out? Anyways, The next item I have here is that there's a double standard for the rich and the poor.
Yes.
Which is life, right? You know what I'm saying?
Again, these are all just like poor plot devices to create drama. Because the whole reason why they're saying she can't have any technology is so that they can find her technology and then have her almost kicked out. But then Mr. Henry Nobly whispers to the richest woman there and goes, pretend it's your cell phone. She won't kick you out if it's your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And then so Lady Amelia Hartwright, who we haven't even talked about, is amazing.
So funny. Oh, my God.
Georgia, played by Georgia King, who I don't know her from anything else, really, but she is so funny in this.
I love how she moves around like a cartoon Victorian ghost. That's my favorite. Right? Her hands lead every movement. Her hands come into
this
the
is how
she does.
She has jello shoulders.
So funny. She just sometimes there's one scene where she's like, Jane, come with me to the drawing room. I need to tell you something in secret. And then she lopes away is the best way I'd be able to describe it. She like it's like very shouldery and lots of knees, high knees.
Yep.
It's very bizarre. Yep.
And she goes, no, no, no. Like, that's how she was acting. And then I love Jane's reaction at the end to be like, oh, you're not British? As if she had put on the best fucking British accent. Like, please. Jennifer Coolidge with her wee-wee was doing a better British accent than Amelia Hartwright was. But anyways, the whole point of all of this bullshit is for poor plot devices to then pretend to move the story along when it's just all very like, oh, and then this, they should say this so that we can say this and this and this. Like, ugh, just so clumsy, you know? Just do better.
Just take time to set it up a bit better.
Yeah, come on. Keep going with your list.
Oh, that's the end of the list. So is there anything you want to talk about before we do our, like,
Let's talk about the romances quickly. So,
if we must.
So okay, we'll save the big romance for the end, but let's talk about Jennifer Coolidge and Colonel Andrews, played hilariously by James Callis, I think.
You know what, actually he might be my favorite. I don't know who's my favorite in this movie. They're all so funny. Yeah. Oh my God,
they're all very funny. And like, see, that's the thing that wins me over about this movie is that they're all very funny. It's very camp. And, like, I appreciate that, but I just want a little bit more for me to care about the parts that you want me to care about, you know?
Yes, preach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When Miss Elizabeth Charming sets her eyes on Colonel Andrews, she's very much, like, holding the back of his neck, trying to kiss him. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's, I feel like, also an ethical breach because these are actors. They don't have to kiss. I don't think you're even really, like, supposed to. You're just supposed to, like, act a romance. I don't think
which
it's encouraged
would be
that, like,
would be the Regency experience, right? Like theoretically, if you wanted to experience Regency romance, you wouldn't even touch bare hands.
Yeah.
You would have gloves on. You know what I mean? Like there was no smooching.
Yeah. Exactly.
There was
making
out in the tall grass by the pond in your Regency era cotton summer dress, even though that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And is one of my favorite scenes.
Their relationship it has me going from me like ew ick because she's doing too much and she's too forceful with him and he obviously is like trying to create boundaries, but then he's just so funny on his own, and then his like fake admiration of her is played very well. Lady Amelia Hartwright's and Captain East think are very funny together. Amazing. Jane and Martin's relationship. What did you think?
High school me would have loved it. You know? And then this me, I was like, they were trying to do the thing of having two people get along really like seamlessly and the conversation really flows and they both enjoy each other's quirky sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And it just like wasn't like, I think that they did the best with the script, but It was kind of like the actual content of the script kind of fell flat for me. And then I think that it was very funny how after it was revealed that Martin was an actor, his complete countenance changed 100%. And he became this little like LA actor dude.
his leather jacket hooked on his finger over his shoulder. Yeah, like Martin I find funny too, but like his, the way that he was like wooing Jane was so just very obviously like, I'm the bad stable boy, and he really leaned into that. And I was like, Jane, you're so desperate, and I understand, girl. I just want better for you.
Yeah.
I want you to have standards. So that was, it's, again, poorly done to then just bring her to the end game, which is Mr. Henry Nobley.
Hubba hubba.
How do you feel about that?
I love the actual, like, relationship between Nobley and Jane, because, I love the theory of it. The execution was left some things to be desired, but there were certain scenes that I loved. Like the croquet scene, for example, they had a bit of banter.
Yes.
Before that, they had had a few interactions and they had clearly been observing each other, and you read a lot of subtext from the observations of each other. And then you start, like, the way that he starts to care about her is palpable. And I think that is really well done. It's interesting too. The thing that I like about their relationship is that she was quite desperate, you know, for love at first. And then there's a certain point where it's like a crux for her, and she kind of takes control of her experience at Austin Land. She becomes a different person almost. So at that point, she just starts letting herself have fun, living to the fullest, not trying to like fit into whatever they've scripted for her. She was like, you know what? Enough. I'm going to do my thing. And that's the point where you see her get quite vivacious and spunkacious. And and that's where you see him start to, like, he had already was kind of, like, looking at her through his little side bangs. And then now you see him kind of start to pursue her a little bit. And she's kind of like, I'm playing the game. I'm doing my own thing. I'm living my life. And he is, and that's when he starts to fall in love with her, when he sees her agency. And then the whole fantasy between the two of them is like two people just being nice together, having fun, and being polite and pure. Like, I love that. It's so sweet.
I like, agreed to everything that you said, obviously. I like when she said, when they have time together, because Lady Amelia Hartwright was like, don't pair up with him. I mean, don't pair up with Captain East, pair up with somebody else, because I want to get my paws on, my little claws on Captain East.
Trying to go down when south on Captain East.
When they have to, Jane and Henry, they have to rehearse for the play, which is an amazing play. Mm-hmm. 10 out of 10 would watch.
Oh, 100%.
when they have to go rehearse and they have their little quiet moments, like in the courtyard or whatever, on that fountain, she says something to him about, like, no, you don't like me, you find me annoying or something. And he's like, I don't dislike you, you make me nervous. And then he just says it and walks away. And that's very nice. And then you discover, like, Jane has been doodling. You see her doodling in her little sketchbook all the time. And he's flipping through it, which, first of all, girl, how could you let anyone see your drawing?
I know, it's basically your diary. Yeesh.
Yeah. Literally the man you are drawing lots and lots of photos of, you're gonna let him look at it? Insane. Ugh. But he's flipping through it and he's like, whoa, there are lots of me in here. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say it in a rude way. He's just like, it's funny how there's lots of me in here. She's like, I'm trying to figure you out, I guess. And I'm like, oh, that's really nice. Because she doesn't even realize that she's, like drawn to him.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's only realizing it, like, yeah. Whoa.
And it's a good response, where the cringy rom-com thing that they could have done was just to have her be flustered. But instead, they actually had something of substance in her response. So
yeah, they had an actual answer as to why she was drawing lots of photos of him.
Yeah,
all their little, like, quiet scenes. And then they have a little very, very romantic intimate moment where, after the play, where they're holding hands and he kisses the inside of her palm.
Oh my god, I know, I inhaled sharply.
I know, they're standing so close and he, like, is holding her hand and he says, he asks her for the first two dances and the next day's ball. And then he's leaving and he kisses the inside of her palm, and I was like, all the breath in my body had left.
Gone. It's shipped off.
It's shipped off. So it's like, you have like good bones. You have good bones. You just like you didn't put the rest of the body together properly. You didn't put your butt into it. They didn't put their butt into it. They put their butt into it. Like other things. And I think it did their overall story, like their overall romance, their endgame romance, a disservice by not getting to that point less awkwardly, you know?
Yes. So let's rewrite this movie as well. After we finish up our rewrite of Little Italy, we'll rewrite this. Kat, what would you rate, how would you rate Austinland out of scale of 10 somethings?
Okay. I feel like I have two ratings, and I think they even out to what the IMDb score is, which is 6.3 wee-wees out of 10. What about you?
I would give Austinland 5.5 enormous blouses out of 10.
I think these are good scores.
Yeah.
For a movie that we know is kind of garbage.
Kind of bonk.
But is also weirdly our comfort movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, isn't that the way, you know? It's always, you love to hate it, right? And we should make that our tagline or something.
Oh my God, it all comes back together. Yeah,
full cycle, you know what I'm saying?
A full cycle.
So, yeah, I think we're of one accord on that. Kat, where can people find you if they want to find you on social media?
They can find me at It's Catherine Ram on any social media. Molly, what about you?
Anyone who wants to follow me on TikTok or Instagram, you can follow me at Molly's Outbox. And you can also follow VomCom on TikTok and Instagram at VomCom Podcast. And also, if you feel like it, you guys should give us a review. Give us a 5-star review. Leave a comment literally anywhere. We love to read them. And also, just find it. We find your opinions interesting, too. We want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Do you have movie recommendations? All of the above is welcome.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening to another Adios. Episode. All right, bye.
I like that ending.
That was a perfect place to end it.
Done!
I am fond of you, you know.
And a girl?
I often wish you weren't such a stinker.